The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. Now, it's becoming a bit of a tradition here on the podcast at this time of year that when Christmas looms, we dedicate the podcast to the Royal Society's Winton Book Prize for science books. Whether you want to make sure you're in the know about the best science writing throughout the year, or whether you just need a good idea for a Christmas present, the Royal Society Winton Book Prize is a good place to start. The shortlist for this year's prize is a handsome list of books that explores our oceans, takes us on a tour of fundamental particles and forces, unveils the mysteries of our brains, and delves into the quirkier end of the animal kingdom. In this programme, we've got two of the panel of judges who had the daunting task of drafting a shortlist and then the excruciating task of picking one of those as a winner. Uta Frith is a distinguished neuroscientist, a fellow of the Royal Society, the British Academy, and the Academy of Medical Sciences. She was the chair of this year's judging panel. John Culshaw is a comedian who's worked in radio and TV. You'll have heard his impressions in the brilliant comedy series Dead Ringers and beyond, but he also has a huge passion for astronomy. And he's brought together both these things recently with a rather wonderful impression of the late astronomer Sir Patrick Moore. Welcome, Uta and John.
Hello there.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Listen, before I go through this entire list of books with you, John, tell me what your normal reading habits are. Do you read science books for pleasure?
Yes, I do. I don't tend to read novels or fiction particularly. I've always been most interested in science books, reference books, fact books.
You want to know
books.
Stuff?
Yes, as a child I used to love reading about dinosaurs, and the Observer's Book of Astronomy by Sir Patrick Moore got me interested in the beginning in astronomy. And this was always my area of reading.
And Uta, you read science all the time. Surely you can't read science for pleasure too.
No. I love reading science books. I always have done so, and I think they were, to some extent, responsible to getting me into science, to really like it and have that feeling that there is so much to find out, and it's this idea of being an explorer of knowledge. So I have a great love of science book reading, but I do read other things as well.
Well, and if it's getting people like you into science, surely that these things, it's an important thing for the future of humanity then, that we have more people reading science books. God, I'm getting on my pedestal there. But I'd love to know the book that got you into science.
I could tell you that.
Go on.
You wouldn't know it. It's a German book, which is called a Street Urchin, something like that, a name that's a very common German name for an urchin, finds his way to technology. Would you believe that? But it had a brilliant cover of a boy climbing an enormous chimney and looking down into this. And I just sort of thought, oh, this cover really interested me. And I was also very interested as a girl to find out what it is actually that, you know, why should boys always read about technology and science? So I really wanted to find out. And that book was rather well written for very young audience, I think, maybe sort of 10, 12-year-olds. And I just enjoyed it.
The first book we're going to talk about is Sean Carroll's book, The Particle at the End of the Universe. John, tell us a bit about this book. What's it about, and did you enjoy it?
I was utterly fascinated by it. It was challenging, it was difficult, but I think so it should be. I will want to go back to this two or three more times, I think, to really let this soak in. But it's all about the Higgs field. It's all about this new area of, feels like the cutting edge, really, the event horizon of where our understanding has reached. And there was quite a few books about the Higgs field and so on, and the Higgs boson and the Large Hadron Collider and what it's trying to discover. But this one felt, I think, the most confident, and I think most deserving to be in the shortlist. It's a wonderful collation of knowledge about, as I say, this area of science, which feels like it's at the event horizon of our understanding. Such a fast-developing area.
Well, it's been a big couple of years for theoretical particle physics, hasn't it? And experimental as well. And we've had so many guests on this show. We've written so many news stories about the Higgs field, and of course, it was all crowned recently when Peter Higgs and François Englert won the Nobel Prize just a few weeks ago for their ideas back in 1962 or 3 or 4. I can't remember exactly the date. But this book by Sean Carroll is a kind of introduction to the idea of the Higgs field, and actually goes beyond just talking about what it is. It's about what it means for the universe, why we need to know this stuff, which I think is what really gives it something different to some of the other books that have been about this.
Yes, exactly. It helps you to imagine the unimaginable, and for it to be written for beginners and to help you get a grasp onto it. That's not to say it's very simplistic, because it is very, very challenging, but it certainly gave me a huge appetite to learn more and more about this and really delve into it to a greater depth.
Uta, I'm going to ask you about what you think of it. I mean, forgive me if I sort of assume that as a neuroscientist you may not be so interested in physics, but is this stuff
drew me in?
It did,
and it was a real joy to read it. I think he is an absolutely phenomenally good writer. He just manages to get that sort of narrative interest. You know, this was short anecdotes. He tells you about people, and he tells you about these amazingly difficult and abstract things, but it's all incredibly exciting.
Do you have to be into the subject?
No.
Do you have to be into Higgs bosons?
No, not at all.
It is really, you know, trying to understand, as John said, you know, to imagine the unimaginable. It really goes like, oh God, no, this is even smaller, or even, we haven't even got a word for this, or we don't know what the dimension is. So I think it carries you into it very, very beautifully and quite dramatically.
I mean, the theories in this area are fizzing around just as fast as the particles themselves. And I think Sean, just the American Professor Brian Cox, I've heard him described as, many of these theories could change as time goes on. You know, none of this is fixed, but I think this book captures, it gives us the best chance of understanding the theories as they are for now in this very fast evolving area of science.
He's a very prominent cosmologist, Sean Carroll, isn't he? I mean, his own blog, The Preposterous Universe, it's full of things that make you question every question you've got. So you ask, this is the problem with quantum physics and cosmology sometimes. You have a question about something, then the cosmologist will always say to you, but you're assuming the wrong things about the structure of the universe in the first place. And I feel that sometimes your foundations can be completely shifted from
That's
under you.
That's so true.
John, I wonder why you think such abstract things are so popular and have been so popular. I mean, Brian Cox is one of the reasons, amongst many, for a lot of this stuff. But why do you think that people are interested so much in such bizarrely abstract things?
There was a phrase of Arthur C. Clarke that the universe is not only weirder than we imagine, it is weirder than we can imagine. And I reckon an enormous amount of that will be discovered in the Higgs field. We just really don't know what's there. I love some of the simplistic descriptions in a nutshell of the Higgs field. And one of them was, you've got like the universe, and like the Higgs field is sort of like a photographic negative of that holds everything up. And, you know, that gives you a little start into it. And what's also great about the light and shade in this book as well is there's great respect for the history and the scientists historically and all of their rivalries and their discoveries that got us to the level where we are now. And imagining the unimaginable, I loved that description of the proton supply for the Large Hadron Collider, and there it is stored in this object that looks rather like a little fire extinguisher. Yet there's enough protons in there to feed the collider for at least 8 billion years, something like that.
I think we'll probably build another collider by then, I'm hoping. All right. Well, that was Sean Carroll's book, The Particle at the End of the Universe, which is all about the Higgs field and why it's so important and why the Higgs discovery of the Higgs boson is going to sort of usher in a new era of physics. Next up, we're looking at Bird Sense, What It's Like to Be a Bird, by Tim Burkhead. John, now give us two things. Would you give us a quick overview of what Tim Burkhead's book is all about, and how are your bird impressions?
Well, I've never really done them, I don't think. Maybe Woody Woodpecker when I was about 4 years old.
He can talk, though.
yes. Well, I saw the title Bird Sense and wondered if this might be quite a specialised book. I think Tim's great triumph in this is to show the infinite diversity that there is within the bird kingdom. It is just so surprising how diverse it is. And it's kind of set out in block sections that cover seeing, hearing, taste and emotions, which work very effectively as a structure. And what struck me straight away is the enormous, practically infinite, as I say, diversity within bird life and the endless issues and experiences they seem to face. Because it's so easy to think of just, you know, a chaffinch on the bird table eating peanuts, or maybe flamingos at the opposite end, the more exotic scale. But Tim's passion is very infectious, and the way he describes, on one hand, the kiwi, and then later he'll describe an emperor penguin, he captures the sense of difference and diversity in such a way that you would think perhaps a rhino is more similar to one of those birds than within the bird kingdom themselves.
And so this book is all about what it's, I mean, it says it in the title, what it's like to be a bird, essentially. Well, what it might be like to experience those things. And so some birds have incredibly good eyesight because that's what they're evolved to do in terms of hunting. Others, like crows, are incredibly clever things, and we know they make tools. Uta, what is it about this book that captured you? I mean, there is this element, especially in the UK and many other countries around the world, where birding and watching birds and spotting birds and things, there's something very aesthetic about it. But this is going deeper than that, isn't it?
Oh, yes. But it is an obsession. There's no doubt about it. I think this is somebody who has spent a lifetime watching particular birds, and in particular, in the case of Tim Burkett, guillemots. And I was particularly fascinated about his descriptions there, about the possible emotions in these birds. Incredibly convincing and very, very much giving you, you know, written in a way that could just give you that glimpse of this incredibly different creature.
How do you measure the emotions in a bird? I mean, are they happy, sad, angry?
They, for example, have the guillemots have a very complex greeting ritual after they've been in mind. They're monogamous, and they pairs, and one flies off, and when they come back, they're clearly, you know, something is happening. They're really very, very pleased. That's all we can say about it. That's an example. They have an extraordinarily cooperative society. They're very social birds. They're very friendly, and they're very, very close together. And what's incredibly amazing is that they actually come back to the very same spot that they nested on the year before. And when we talk about the same spot, it seems to be sort of like, you know, half a square meter, something like that, or even less. So how they can do all that, it really is extraordinary, and does show you there's some different kind of intelligence.
I loved as well the descriptions you got of birds that you'd never heard of before, such as a whiskered auklet, which is a North Pacific seabird. And I wondered if Tim, with his great passion and vast knowledge of birds, if he had a particular favourite. I wondered if it might be some prehistoric Archaeopteryx or something like that. But it was rather refreshing and charming that his favourite bird was a sylph hummingbird, which was sort of a cross between a kingfisher and a moth, I think. And it was rather charming that was his favourite.
Tiny.
Yes, yeah. Rooting for the underdog or the underbird.
I was going to say that the birds have a quite distinguished evolutionary history, being the descendants of the dinosaurs. And so, you know, the T-Rex and stuff still lives within our chicken dinners, to be honest. But the amount of information coming out about bird behaviour, intelligence, as you said, Uta, eyesight, taste, touch, all these things. How has Tim Burkhead sort of avoided just having a list of facts about what we know about birds? Because, I mean, what I worry about is if you're not into the idea of reading about birds and you don't want to know all this list, what's the writing like to draw you into it?
I think it is very, very much personalised. He does talk about his own experiences, you know, his own family, his own childhood, and how important it is, you know, to just carry on really observing. Sometimes you may wait days and not get what you want, and you have this, you know, exhilaration at making that critical observation, but it is an account of a whole lifetime of bird watching, I think.
Yes, it is the personalisation of it, and Tim's personality comes across in the writing. Got the vernacular of a novel, but based in hard fact. And certain sections, I read them as Les Dawson for some reason. I don't know why.
Is he a bird watcher?
Well, it was just the erudite language reminded me of him.
Les Dawson.
For instance, just think of the staggering variety of feather postures birds use, including the fan-like opening of a peacock's train, the flamboyant fluffing of a displaying great busted male, and the sleek plumage of an intimidated blue tit. It just made me think of Les Dawson.
You need that little growl at the end of it.
Yes. It was an Alan Bennett reminder later on
in
one of the descriptions. As a boy, I was an avid collector of bird skulls. One of my most prized possessions was the skull of a woodcock, a probing bird with enormous eye sockets and a distinctive pitted bill tip. These pits can only be seen after the leathery covering of the bill, the rhamphorica, has been removed.
Well, I'm intrigued to hear what Tim actually sounds like after all this.
Do you know, sections when I read it and I thought, I wonder if he sounds like Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
But then I looked at a YouTube clip and there he was at the University of Sheffield, and he says...
Oh, he does have a nice Yorkshire accent then.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the warmth comes across.
Yes, it does, yes.
Well, I was going to say, it would be kind of amusing if you had a cut glass Radio 4 sort of accent after all that.
No, not at all.
But okay, so I mean, either of you, are you bird people?
Bit more so now.
Really?
I will have much more respect for pigeons.
Okay.
And I will...
Flying rats, aren't they? Is that right?
Now that we have this insight into how they think and feel and function, it's immensely more sophisticated.
Amazing navigators.
I certainly was completely surprised to learn that owls would have these big eyes and, the feathers around it. Don't see particularly well. They do it all by hearing. And that's, in fact, why the eyes are so much in the front of the head. So Tim Burkett explains all this beautifully. It's really so there is more space for their ears because they fly
that's
in the
interesting.
Dark.
And what,
they
what,
really do it all by
what
sound.
What are they doing with their eyes then? They're just there for so that you have something to look at.
Well, they do. They do. They're not entirely solely nocturnal. I think their hunting is nocturnal. So I presume they use their eyes during day, but at night they can swoop on a tiny rodent or something like that. Just by using their amazing hearing.
Quite alien senses for us to think about. Yeah. And the insight you get into things that you think are really rather peaceful and gentle, like the dawn chorus, this glorious signal to start the day, is actually sort of a frantic mass call of territorialism, these birds claiming their territory. Thanks to reading Bird Sense, I will view the dawn chorus as a much more chaotic sense of discord than a peaceful start to the day.
Thank you very much. That was Bird Sense by Tim Burkhead. Let's turn to our own species now, and to that organ in the human body that assembles and creates meaning out of our senses, the brain. In particular, memory. Pieces of Light, The New Science of Memory by Charles Fernyhough. Uta, this is your career's been based on examining cognition and neuroscience. Give us your neuroscientist take on this. And I bet Charles is, when he's if he listens to this, he's going to be gnawing his teeth right now about what you think of his book.
I really have most enormous respect for Charles Fernyhough. I think it's a brilliant book. He has achieved something very original. It's not just teaching us new things about memory. I mean, the science of memory really has progressed in recent years. And it is very timely, I think, that there is more talked about it so that everybody knows about this research that's going on. That, for example, has told us that we cannot actually rely on our conviction that we remember something. We think we remember because it's so vivid to us. We believe that we can trust our memories. I think he really makes very beautifully and very gently clear that this is all very, very much an illusion and that we are doing all a lot of constructing. And he does it in such an interesting way because he uses his own insights, his introspection, and that of his friends. So he really takes us on a journey and he tries to reconstruct memories of, for example, Cambridge, where he hadn't been for many years, or a part of Sydney in Australia. He talks to his children about what their earliest memories. Again, we know much, much more about this kind of work than we ever knew before. And it is very interesting that he can inspire through this book, I think, the reader to introspect too, and to question what they think their earliest memories actually were. Were they really memories? Were they just stories that were built
yes,
up?
Yes, that was a fascinating aspect of this that came out, how suggestible and programmable the memory is. That description of the study done by Kimberly Wade at the University of Warwick, where students were given made-up photos, invented photos of themselves in events which hadn't actually taken place, their heads superimposed onto some event, I don't know, a balloon flight or something like that. And half of the students recalled memories of these events which hadn't taken place.
What was going on?
Yes,
that
in
day
great
and
detail.
How much they enjoyed it.
So just because a memory might be vivid, doesn't mean it's actually true.
Which is worrying for court cases.
I think it shows the whole area of memory and the science of memory to have been hugely underestimated, and we barely know a fragment of it. And to show that it is not just like a list of picture cards in an album or football stickers where it's just all in a list there, but this ebbing and flowing and mercurial, unpredictable living entity was really quite fascinating. It's as though the area of memory has its own Higgsfield, this own area of it that we really don't understand.
I like your attempts at unification here. Yes. Unified theories of science.
My memories of reading it were very good anyway.
Well, that's good.
And well, maybe they're staying that way.
Maybe they're fallible. Who knows? We can probably talk about the brain for an infinite amount of time, but we should probably pause and move on to the next book in our list. This is The Book of Barely Imagined Beings by Casper Henderson. John, you're going to take us through the introduction to this. I mean, essentially, from cave paintings to wildebeest to Herman Melville's Moby Dick, you know, representations and evocations of the animal world have intrigued us all. And Casper Henderson's book is a sort of catalogue of our obsession with animals. Just tell us how he's put this together.
Well, the setting of the book, the styling of it, the production of it, it's wonderful in the sense of, you know, Montgolfier Bloons or a medieval bestiary. Phileas Fogg, that's the kind of setting of it, the visual appearance of it. And the beautifully imagined animals. I've always been fascinated by cryptozoology, searching for the Ogopogo or the Sasquatch, things like that, animals which are yet to be discovered. And there's something so beautiful about these creatures, which are probably the most unusual that we do know.
They're all real, though.
They are all real, yes, they are all real. But Casper's passion for describing them, he's rather like a circus ringmaster, as he tells us about all the incredible delights of these astonishing creatures. And there is a stage where he gets to, just when you think he's maybe having a tea break and going to some less unusual creatures, and he's focusing on sponges, which you think are going to be, oh, well, this is going to be calm for a short section. And he makes sponges seem like the most incredibly sophisticated creatures that have ever existed.
How does he pull that illusion off? I'm curious to know.
One of them that he describes is, I can't recall the name of it at the moment, but two sponges where the male and the female sort of grow and fuse together, and it looks as though they are fused and locked in some sort of eternal embrace, which the Japanese viewed as a symbol of everlasting love and passion. Well, and all of this from a sponge.
All this from a sponge. Yes. I mean, as you sort of said, bestiaries are part of a long tradition. I mean, we've had books of miscellany, and it does have that, like I said, a slightly oldie-worldy feel. The book is a brilliant, gorgeous object. It's beautifully produced. I just wonder how important that is in terms of your enjoyment of it, because there is a worry I had when reading this book myself that it would just be a list of interesting animals with no through narrative. It's not quite like that. But what kept me going was just how beautifully produced it was. And I wanted to see what else they were going to come up with.
Yes, I think that's what we said at some of the judging
sessions. I should have been on your judging panel.
one of the most regularly made comments about Barely Imagined Beings was everybody said, oh, I just loved this. Yeah. And our kids loved this, and it brought back memories of when you were younger and that sense of fascination. It just tapped into something. But as well as that, as well as being beautifully produced in this wonderfully imaginative, artful way, there's a great level of detail going in there. They really do decode these creatures fascinatingly.
Uta, you've talked about the book as an object before,
an object of desire,
which you know, let's admit yes. That's not the main purpose of a book, but it kind of is a little bit, isn't it?
I think it is. I think this book does remind us that you just want to look at the appearance as well as the words. And it does, it really is a special book, which we love to open. You know, it has red font, it has black font, it has lots of very quirky kind of drawings.
Not enough like that anymore, are there, books like that?
There aren't. And it seems that with actually many of the other books that we judged, the publishers didn't seem to take too much trouble in helping the authors to give very good illustrations. And I feel that's incredibly sad. You know, of course it's expensive to do this, but on the other hand, people don't just want to have these books on Kindle, do they? They do yeah. want to have a wonderful option. At least I want
well,
to
that's
have
what
that.
I was going to say. That's what there is maybe a generational thing here in that some people just do want books, 100 books on a Kindle and a couple of images and things. But they miss the smell of books, the sort of feel of them and stuff. Let's not go into a discussion about the beauty of books, but just go back to my earlier question, John. You talked about the level of detail in each of these entries and the sort of fascination with the animals and things. And there are some crazy animals here, like the axolotl, the weird sort of bizarre undersea creature and various other things. But going back to my initial question, which is, does it give you something more than just a list of miscellany about animals?
It felt as though it did. It felt like a more unusual, a more imaginative, a more offbeat look into natural history. There was a real personality to it, and just decoding a sense that these creatures are much more mysterious than we give them credit for, not just creatures existing now, but I think it's a nice touch that he does include some of the more unusual prehistoric creatures as well, such as the Quetzalcoatlus and the Ornithochirus. I think that's in there.
Well pronounced. I would never have been able to do that, even if it was written
also
down.
Also, intriguingly, it includes human.
Exactly.
Well, we are animals.
Yes, but you don't expect to be listed in this.
Against those exotic animals. I do think it goes further than just a miscellany, because it is very, very erudite about evolution, and it does give you a deeper sense that connects all these different creatures. And I think that's very well done, actually.
Mm. I think it would make a wonderful BBC One series, something like that. It was very evocative of some programmes I was very fond of when I was younger. David Attenborough's Fabulous Animals, or Lost Worlds, Vanished Lives, another one that David Attenborough presented, but for many creatures which are around now.
Okay, let's move on to our fifth book. This is Ocean of Life by Callum Roberts. Now, this is not so much about the mystery of the seas, but the very survival of the oceans and seas that are at stake here. Now, Uta, you're going to introduce this book for us. It's a book about everything in the sea.
I love this book. I was completely enthralled, I think, by the first 20 or so pages, because I have never read such an absolutely concise, beautiful account of the whole history of the Earth. I think just alone that, you know, sort of deserves some kind of prize. And, you know, there's sort of deep questions about why is there water on Earth? What is underneath? How much are we aware of only the very, very surface of the oceans as opposed to deeper layers? Where is the life? What is happening? And it does really provide a lot of completely interesting questions that you didn't even think of asking perhaps before, and very, very interesting answers. But I think this is a book that has excellent illustrations that are really relevant to the text. And I pick out one, which I found extraordinarily telling. So it's the outcome of, people fishing and, you know, how they're proudly photographed with what they fished from the sea. This is in Florida. So these typical things, you know, smiling people, and there are these, you know, fish which so proudly they're caught. And the picture of the 1920s, it was just enormous fish. In the 1950s, medium-sized fish. Nearly present day, they are tiny. It's absolutely astonishing to look at that. And yet, of course, the people who caught them are equally proud in all of these things. They it's almost as if they didn't realize this enormous change over, maybe 100 years or so.
That, for me, symbolized the entire book, really. What was the shifting baseline syndrome, I think that was called. The reduction in the sizes of the fish because of the aggressive overfishing happening over a period of time whereby, as you say, Jutta, they didn't notice it was happening.
That's right. That's the extraordinary thing. And he does give very interesting information about what's happening to the food we take for granted that we eat. And he actually gives some quite sort of practical advice of what is safe to eat, what is fine. So it is, in a sense, a wake-up call, and saying, oh, my God, this is all this happening. You know, our life depends on it. This is, I suppose, the title, Ocean of Life. But he's not saying, oh, doom, gloom, but he's actually really rather optimistic and positive. And he says, you know, this is what could be done, or, this might be the alternative.
This is one of the best written books that I've read in a long time about anything to do with science, if I'm honest. It's just obviously Callum Roberts is an expert in this. This is his life's work, to look at the oceans and look at what's going on in them. And so he writes with that authority and that confidence. But it's an enjoyable book to read, despite its slightly dark message we have kind of screwed things up.
Yeah.
It is an extraordinary thing, given that it's very easy to sort of think that books like this are sort of campaigning and beating you over the head with the problems. And I just wonder, John, when you read it, did you feel like you're being given a lesson about how bad human beings are or anything like that? Because, I mean, I think that's the kind of thing that would turn me off something like a book like this.
Not quite. It didn't quite feel like that. But you do get a sense of, look, this is very, very important. Don't let this issue creep up on us. You know, we hear an awful lot about climate change, an awful lot about melting polar ice caps, and the message was, we'd better not forget the oceans as well, and the potential problems that can come there. And I felt a very trustworthy sense from Callum on this book. The passion comes across, and you really feel as though he's championing this area of conservation and saying, please, please, don't underestimate this. He doesn't do it in a sort of a browbeating, doom and gloom sort of way, but he says, this is very important.
I've heard this book called an environmental manifesto, a bit like Rachel Carson's book from the 60s, Silent Spring. Mm. Would that be fair?
I think it is fair. I have to say, I really recommend this book to everybody. It's so interesting to read. It is just really gripping, because it really brings it home to you how important the oceans are, how dramatic life is there, how dramatic the changes are.
And if that's not convinced you, you can listen to our interview with Callum Roberts, and he speaks beautifully too, would you believe? That's probably, you would believe that, but he speaks very, very, very well, and you could listen to him for a long time talking about this stuff. And I think the thing is, with the oceans, with seas, they're always there, aren't they? That's the thing. And so therefore it's very easy to, in a way, ignore they are.
And it is, and we think of the oceans as just infinite, really. You can do anything with them, that you can just keep plundering it, you can just keep chucking anything in. And the descriptions of this sort of like coalescing rubbish tip in the North Pacific.
This is very interesting that I especially looked this up. What is the size of the plastic rubbish that's gyrating in the Pacific Ocean? Well, it's the size of Texas twice.
Wow. Yeah. This is just rubbish that hasn't biodegraded anywhere.
And it's plastic, sludge, and it's sort of forming together a bit like
a gyre.
And what happens? I mean, this thing is just, can it be skimmed off and removed? It's too big, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, there is some, there, he did just discuss a few, you know, there are experiments so that, you know, people who can't fish anymore, they might be employed to clean up some rubbish. But there's something else interesting happening with the plastic, that it degrades into tiny, tiny particles. And they're everywhere, apparently, on the beaches. You just have to look at the microscope. They're already just, you know, degraded as much as they can be, and they're just part of the nature as we see it. You know, we go to the beach, we think sand, stones, but that's how it's always been, of course. And the oceans haven't always been as they are now. That's the other interesting thing to learn from this book. You know, there've been huge changes in how, you know, that they might have been for long periods quite poisonous for life. And other periods, so they were the source of much of the species diversity.
And of course, it's where life evolved, I mean, most probably.
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to our final book. This is Cells to Civilizations, The Principles That Changed the Shape of Life by Enrico Cohen. So moving on from vast oceans, we're going to go to the smallest possible bits of life, these cells. And Uta, you're going to take us through this book. Now, Enrico Cohen, he presents the key debates in the areas of evolutionary and biological science by referencing fine art. Does it work?
I think it does. It's an unbelievably ambitious book. I think it's the most ambitious of our shortlist, but it works. Clearly, this is a man with a Renaissance mind, and that's how he can bring in the art, which is very interesting educational means also for the reader to make some analogies, which he's pointing out all the time. Now, one of the aims of this book is actually to tell you about analogies at a very abstract level, of course. So that's why it's called Cells to Civilizations. I mean, as you say, cells, we start with the very smallest, but civilizations, plural.
Lots of cells.
It's really, you know, the very biggest, and it's, these are structures over time and space, and they're societies. And he manages to draw this from what he calls life's creative recipe, which he describes again and again, because it is novel, it is highly original, and you know, there has to be a lot of kind of pedagogy as you go through this book. So it is a demanding book. You could say it's a really challenging book. But my God, when you read it, you are richly rewarded.
Well, when you're faced with so much stuff, Cells to Civilization is basically everything in terms of anything that life has done and can understand. So you've got a huge, rich amount of material. And the trick then in the writing is to give you a narrative, a structure that you can follow, which keeps you moving along. And I just wonder, you know, sometimes with these sorts of constructions of books, whether the author's taking too much, biting off more than you can chew. I mean, obviously, now it's on the shortlist, so you thought that it worked. But there is a danger, isn't there, that in such a large area, like a book about life, you can go in any direction you like.
There are two dangers, aren't there? There's one that it's just, you know, too big a job to take on. And the other extreme is you take a very thin topic, you maybe turn it into a very riveting story, but that's a sort of lightweight. And you should take care of also, you know, to try and understand those really ambitious writers who have something very new to say and who have worked on how they can communicate this. They're not just talking to their colleagues. They are really trying to talk to maybe, you know, budding scientists to scratch their heads and say, well, you know, how should we understand evolution? You know, we have these vaguest terms. He is saying something, well, I think we can talk about a recipe of nature. And he has, you know, particular kind of processes that he talks about all the time, you know, like cooperation and competition and recursion and, you know, recombination, all of these things. And he will very impressively show that this is all you need to understand remarkable things in nature at every level, you know, at the level of the first, you know, origin of life in cells, to the development of the embryo, to art, of course, and to even social interaction in animals and, of course, also in humans. So it is unbelievably ambitious, and he has produced something, I think, that is really an amazing sort of food for thought.
John, you're a man on the cusp of science and art, if I can put it that way. Well, yes. You know,
that's a nice parking space.
Have you? Well, I just wonder, as someone who has an intelligent layman's interest in science, but your career is in art. What was your view of the way he approached this subject of life? Because that's what he was doing. Enrico Coombe is doing, is trying to take this very, very scientific discussion of evolution and society and the rise of all these things, but done through a very cultural lens, as it were.
Yes, I thought there was a beautiful flamboyance about that. I would love to see him presenting a live lecture. I imagine his gesticulations would be huge and he would stride around everywhere.
Lots of art shown in slides.
Yes. And I loved his imaginative use of analogies. I won't say barking mad. Sometimes you think, you know, that analogy shouldn't have worked, but they sort of do because they capture your imagination. Cellular formations, rather like a conversation at a dinner party where two people are having a chat. And then one other person joins them, and then there's three people having a chat, and then other people notice from afar, thinking, oh, that looks interesting, I'll join in, and then all of a sudden there's a clump of a conversation going on.
Sounds like the Higgs boson to me.
You see these similar patterns that occur in so many different areas. And that wonderful analogy of how cannon fire, bombards, developed by Leonardo da Vinci at times of war in his life, and how Enrico Coombe takes us from that and links it to how primates can trigger predictions and learn habits to find out which is the more valuable food source to grab hold of. Linking those things together really shouldn't work, but he manages it.
Is there some post-rationalisation going on here?
Well, this is a grand theory, but look, it's all cutting edge science. Every single chapter, it is something that, you know, he has made his task not easy, but really difficult, and he's still managed to, you know, make it into a readable book, a challenging but enjoyable book.
You both said it's challenging. Would you recommend it for someone who maybe hasn't read too many science books? Is it too tough for those people, or can anyone get something out of this at whatever level?
Yes.
You like?
I think so. The analogies will guide people.
Yes.
Through the, you know.
Yes.
The symbolism of cellular cultures. Yeah. That form,
I mean,
rather like a dinner party.
Know, it is the opposite of dumbing down, and we should, you know, not
always
patronise people and say, oh, it has to be really easy, it has to be page turn or something like that. No, you will feel your little cells working. Your brain will have a workout.
Well, we like to think this podcast is the example of not dumbing down by making it as complex as possible to understand. And if more than one person gets the end of things, well, you know, that's great. We'll wind up the discussion about the books there, but can I ask you both just a couple of general things about the list this year? When you are sort of going through, I don't know, scores of books you must have been sent. I just want to know, how did you get from what it must have been like several, in the low hundreds, I'm assuming.
Oh, it was about 150 to begin with.
From 150 to 6. I mean, was it? Did you hate science books at the end of all that?
No, not at all.
You being honest.
Not at all.
Because the more you go along, it accelerates. Rather like learning the lines, you get faster as you go along. You get into your rhythm, your momentum.
There is sort of regret because there were books that were sort of now overlooked because it had to be, you know, ruled out. That, you know, I feel.
Well, that's what I'm asking. I was going to ask you. The six. We'll find out who the winner is. Very soon. But were there books that you wouldn't be happy to name, which were, you think, oh, you know, I wouldn't have minded if this was also
on
the list.
Yeah. Plenty.
Go
yes.
on.
I'd like to have, looking back, Discord, The Story of Noise, was fascinating. A sort of a document of civilization and by the acoustic scenery of the time. And I thought that the theatre of the mind that came from that book, I thought was a wonderful imaginative way of,
bringing
the past to life. Yeah, Discord, the story of noise. Such an original angle to come at something from.
But how do you know what the noise of a sort of Roman battalion was, or the music they were playing? I mean, we don't have recordings of any of these things.
No.
This kind of gave you the theatre of the mind to get as close to that as perhaps we possibly can without watching a Ridley Scott movie.
Uta?
Well, I loved Philip Ball's Curiosity. I thought that was really tremendous.
That was a great book. All right, well, you're not going to answer this question, but will you tell me who won?
We will not tell you. Could you not guess? Analyse what we talked about this book.
It's not enough time. If I just go down this list of books, will you just like nod when I get
to
the
right? No, I think we're not allowed to do that.
All right. Well,
then you won't be in any temptation.
The chair of judges says no, so I'm afraid we'll have to listen to her.
Suffice to say, the one that won was very deserving.
And it was unanimous.
Well,
yes.
Okay, well, that's it for our reviews of this year's Royal Society Winton Book Prize. You can read reviews in print of all of these books on The Guardian's website. Go to theguardian.com/science. And the winner will be announced on the evening of Monday, November 25th at the Royal Society. Many thanks to Uta Frith and John Coleshaw for taking us on this amazing tour of the shortlist. Thank you very much both.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Science Weekly soon. But until then, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.